This week on COVID, race, and democracy.
This is a school. This is a school that two mothers and some other parents and community members are trying to keep open.
Parents and teachers occupying Oakland Parker Community School were attacked by Oakland Unified School District security guards.
They're going into our building. They stole all kinds of equipment, material. They took our radio station off the air for a time. And they stole 40 years of archives. So that's the thing that we have to deal with and are dealing with. We're the African People's Socialist Party, and as they say in St. Louis, we ain't scared.
The FBI is yet again targeting Black radical organizations which assert their right to speak in opposition to U.S. policies domestically and internationally.
Over the decades, as a result of resistance and court cases, filing cases in the court, we slowly began to expand what solitary confinement looked like.
A Black August salute to former political prisoner, Black Panther activist, organizer, and author Albert Wood Fox, who transitioned last Thursday in New Orleans.
Increasingly, what we see with technology is more invasive ways in which to surveil the worker.
And your emotions and temperature are now being captured by artificial intelligence to increase productivity at the workplace. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Black Panther Party member Albert Wood Fox was an activist and author who was caged in solitary confinement for nearly 44 years in Louisiana State Prison, formerly known as Angola, on armed robbery charges in 1965. Wood Fox was wrongfully convicted of the 1972 murder of prison guard Brent Miller, along with the late Herman Wallace. Wallace and Wood Fox, who is now an ancestor, along with Robert King, became the Angola Three political prisoners. The prison was located at the site of a former plantation called Angola. After the African country from which most of the plantation's enslaved people had been captured. According to The Guardian, his convictions for Miller's murder was overturned multiple times throughout his solitary confinement. The warden of Angola admitted under oath in legal depositions that they were being held in CCR, close cell restricted, where prisoners were locked up alone for at least 23 hours a day. Because of their, quote, pantherism, Wood Fox gained his freedom on his 69th birthday in 2016 after a plea deal to lesser charges. He spent the next 6 years educating the U.S. and the world on the horrors of the criminal justice system and advocating against solitary confinement. Wood Fox said the strength and determination of his beloved mother, Miss Ruby Mabel Hamblin, instilled in him to keep going. Here's veteran journalist and host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, along with Albert Wood Fox.
When you got out of jail, the first thing you did was go to your mother's grave.
Yes.
When did she die?
She died in 94, December.
More than 20 years before you got out.
Yeah, in the African-American household, it is always coming to terms with the lost one of someone in the family, when you can say that final goodbye, when you can say from your heart and your soul, I love you and I'll miss you, but I'll never forget you. And so I was denied that right. I was denied the right to go to my mom's wake or funeral and say that final goodbye. So I had to live with that burden, you know, until the day I was released from prison. And the same thing with my sister, you know, when I lost my sister in 2002, both to cancer. The lawyers had made arrangements for me to attend the funeral. But on the day that the sheriffs from Orleans Parish come to pick me up, Warden Kane canceled everything. Now, this is a man who projected the image of being a Christian and believing in family and everything. But yet, because of my political belief, because they couldn't break me, because I would never renounce the Black Panther Party, as they demanded as a turn from being released from solitary confinement, I guess he saw another opportunity to inflict pain upon me. And so I was denied the right to, say goodbye to my sister. And on the day I was released, we went straight to the graveyard, and the graveyard was closed because there had been a two-hour delay in releasing me. I wanted to climb over the fence, and my brother was like, no. We're not having that. You just got out of prison. We're not going to, give these people. So we left with a deep heart, and we went and said goodbye to my sister and my brother-in-law, who was also a childhood friend. And the next day, with an abundance of flowers, we went. And I was finally able to lift that burden that I had carried for so long.
I wanted actually to go to your brother, who you remain close to, Michael Mabel.
Yes.
You remain close to him in prison. I wanted to go to your brother, Michael Mabel, who you remain close to in prison and who was there to greet you when you got out in 2016. When you joined us days later on Democracy Now!, he was there, too.
Yes.
And he described for us how those first days after getting out, you visited your mother's grave.
It was closure for him. I periodically always visit my mother's grave. My mother took her last breath with me holding her hands, and I would always let him know how she went and how much, she continues to look down and know that he's going to struggle for the right thing in this world. And, him and King and Hooks have always given me strength to go against the world. And, no matter what happens, is that if you continue to hope and strength and you fight for a right cause, then you can do anything you want.
So that's Michael, your brother. That was just a few days after you got out. So I want to go back to your time in prison. It's amazing to me that rather than just leaving it all behind, it already consumed so many decades of your life. You are spending your life free talking about what's happening inside. I think, to say the least, it's impossible for anyone who hasn't gone through this to understand what it means to live in a 6-by-9-foot cell for more than 4 decades. How did you maintain your sanity? Describe for us, being in that cell, what it felt like.
Actually, the measurements of the cell are 6 feet wide, 9 feet long. But there is actually less space available because you have two bunks attached to the wall that takes up half of the cell. And you have a toilet bowl, face bowl combination on the back wall. And you have an iron table with a bench on the thing. So you have a very narrow pathway in which you can move back and forth in the cell. When you first put in solitary confinement, you go through this period where you want to scream, because nothing you can do to fight this. In hindsight, I would say it was probably the earliest stage of claustrophobic. Depending on the individual, as time goes on, you learn to control your emotions, your feeling of being smothered and being confined, but then we first put this in solitary confinement. You could only have like 2 or 3 pair of underwear and a T-shirt, and you couldn't have books or radios. Those things were gained later as a result of resistance and organizing and hunger strikes and stuff like it, that we won the right to, change.
What access did you have to reading material, to books?
At that time, only a Bible. They had a Bible in each cell. But the thing was that so many other prisoners had gained respect for what we were trying to do, that, they would actually take a chance and sneak us like newspapers and novels and books like it there. But as I said, over the decades, as a result of a resistance and court cases, filing cases in the court, we, you know, slowly began to expand what solitary confinement looked like.
That was the voice of Black Panther Party member and former political prisoner and advocate against solitary confinement, Albert Wood Fox, along with Amy Goodman. He made his transition on Thursday from coronavirus complications, according to his lawyers, George Kendall and Kareem Williams, as well as his brother, Michael Maple. Wood Fox was also an organizer and educator who taught people how to read and write while in prison. Find out more about Albert Wood Fox. His memoir was published in 2019, and it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, entitled Solitary, Unbroken by Four Decades in Solitary Confinement, My Story of Transformation and Hope.
I'm gonna take myself a piece of sunshine and paint it all over my sky, yeah. Be no rain. Take the song from every bird and make them sing it just for me, yeah. Birds got something to teach us all about being free, yeah.
The great Gil Scott-Heron, I Think I'll Call It Morning. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Last week, COVID, Race, and Democracy reported on the FBI raid of the African People's Socialist Party Yahuru House in St. Petersburg, Florida, and the Yahuru Solidarity Center in St. Louis, Missouri. The raids were conducted as part of the indictment of a Russian national accused of acting as a foreign agent in the U.S., but the FBI's actions are part of an old U.S. playbook targeting Black radical organizations which assert their rights to speak in opposition to U.S. policies domestically and internationally. Omali Yeshitela is chairman of the African People's Socialist Party and leader of the Uhuru Movement and the Black is Back Coalition. He spoke with Margaret Kimberly on Black Agenda Radio. Here is part of their conversation.
The African People's Socialist Party's Uhuru House was raided by the FBI in St. Petersburg, Florida, as well as the Uhuru Solidarity Center in St. Louis, Missouri. The raids were conducted as part of the indictment of a Russian national accused of, quote, knowingly and willfully combine, conspire, and agree with other persons, known and unknown to the grand jury, to commit an offense against the United States, that is to act as an agent of a foreign government and foreign officials, to wit, the Russian Federation and officials of that government, unquote. Charges like these are part of an old playbook used by the state in this country. There are new elements to this story, but some which are known by anyone who is aware of the treatment of Black people who assert their rights to make political demands. Thank you so much for joining us, Omali.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here, sister.
So can you tell us, I read from the indictment, but that never tells the whole story. Why was the African People's Socialist Party targeted?
I'm convinced that the African People's Socialist Party was targeted because for the first time in more than three generations, the struggle of our people has achieved leadership and a capacity that moves us beyond simply talking about the issue and toward the actual struggle to conquer and wield political power, to achieve real self-determination over our lives. And this is more than what Karl Marx once referred to as simply philosophers interpreting the world, but an actual move to change the world. And I think that this on-the-ground kind of struggle that we're engaged in, not only in the United States, but throughout the world, that's involved in organizing African, essentially African working class people to achieve political power. I think that this is a fundamental contradiction that they're dealing with. And because the African People's Socialist Party has identified the colonial contradiction, the colonial mode of production, as the fundamental contradiction that is responsible for all of the suffering and misery of the peoples of the world, I think we became that kind of target. Friday at 5 o'clock in the morning, they waited an hour too long. It came at 4 for Fred. But at 5 o'clock in the morning, my wife and I were sitting discussing how we were going to be moving. And she had this project where a three-day training program for 20 women, African women, young women, working class women, we're going to become doulas, be training this process, train them. And so she's talking about that. And I'm up early because when I can, I'm hitting the gym early in the morning. So we're just sitting talking. Then all of a sudden, this booming noise from this sound system outside, the people who are in this address come out with your hands up. This is the FBI with nothing in your hands, et cetera. At first, it was startling because it was not anticipated at all. So I'm concerned overall, but I'm telling my wife, I'm going to go downstairs. I will go down first. Stay here. Get on the phone. Start calling people. Let people know what's happening. Of course, she couldn't be successful because they jammed our phones. So I'm on the way downstairs and I go downstairs and open the door. And when I open the door, these laser targeting lights are bouncing off my chest. So they're going to kill me. That's clear that these laser points are in my chest. And this is not play stuff they're doing. And I remember Bobby Hutton stumbling and they killed him in Oakland, California. And so I'm saying, myself that they're going to kill me. So I'm walking down the stairs with my hands up. My wife on her way down the stairs, the door is open. She's confronted by a drone that goes past her face up the stairs into the house. At the same time, there are these booms of these blasts going off, this flashbang grenades all around the place. Boom, 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 boom. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. And then outside in front of my house, there is this armored vehicle. You have these camouflaged wearing thugs with guns, automatic weapons, et cetera, that's deployed all around the place. They're on the neighbor's porch. They put tape on the doorbell camera of the neighbor so nobody can see them. There's no record of what they're doing. And so when I get downstairs, they are telling me that I'm asking them what the hell is going on. And then they're saying that they had a search warrant for my house. So let me see it. We don't have it right now, but it's somewhere over there, et cetera, et cetera. And my wife, and then so they zip tie me behind my back. My wife, they put handcuffs on her. They want us to sit on the curb, which is ridiculous. And they say, well, you can sit in the back seat of the car. And they say my phone that, if you open up your phone and you can get it back much sooner. If you open the phone so we can get into it, you can get it back much sooner. So we don't cooperate like that. I don't know at the time, but there's a solidarity component of our movement of white people who've opened up a center in the white sector, primarily white area of St. Louis. an African People Solidarity Committee, a solidarity center with reparations now on the thing and calling on white people to pay reparations to these programs that the Russians had nothing to do with, but many, 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 many white people. That basketball court, we got donations of $5, $10, $50,000 and things like that by white people who say, we want to pay reparations to black people. We want to make a rectification of the relationship that we have the black people. And this is what, you know, what they, the work they are responsible for. There are, we have these forces function in 137 cities in the United States. And they do work every day around the question of reparations to black people. They take out the issues and struggles of black people. And so that's what they do out of there. 30 states in this country, they operate. This is who the African People's Socialist Party is. This, we're not some, you know, like fly-by-night things who simply run around protesting. We actually have genuine strategic aims that we are in the process of always accomplishing that will bring power that negates the power of the colonizer and transfers power to our people. So it's not just a matter of saying no. Negating is not just a matter of saying no. It's saying no, but in the process of saying no, it's constructing a whole new reality at the same time. That's why we are under attack. So anyway, they attack the Solidarity Center. They come, they use battering rams, knock the doors open, even though people were offering them the combination, how to get in. They use battering rams to knock the door down. They use flashbang grenades inside the place. They go upstairs where there's an apartment upstairs and the man and woman who live upstairs in bed, they pull them out of bed, they put them in handcuffs, guns in their faces, and hold them there for 6 hours. For 6 hours, they hold them there while they go ransacking the place, take their recording and communication devices. The same time, our office in St. Petersburg, Florida, they attacked that office in St. Petersburg, Florida. They used battering rams, knocked the doors in, and their pictures that some people have seen on CNN or something, all these soldiers going into our building. They stole all kinds of equipment, materials. They took our radio station off the air for a time, and they stole 40 years of archives. So that's the thing that we had to deal with and are dealing with. We're the African People's Socialist Party, and as they say in St. Louis, we ain't scared.
I'm sure you are. Thank goodness.
That was Chairman Omali Yeshitela of the African People's Socialist Party speaking to Margaret Kimberly on Black Agenda Radio. As Margaret Kimberly wrote in the Black Agenda Report, one need not be familiar with every aspect of the African People's Socialist Program in order to defend them at this juncture. They are the first, but they will not be the last. Every individual or organization which has publicly condemned U.S. policy visited a nation which the U.S. doesn't like or communicated with individuals or groups in those places is at risk of being awakened by flashbang grenades and having electronic devices confiscated, like APSP members last week. The word solidarity must take on a very serious meaning. Sometimes you gotta run, and sometimes you gotta fight, 'cause sometimes it's right and wrong, but sometimes you could lock me and throw the key, but you can't stop me, I know I'm free. Funny thing, I've been here before, nothing short of a miracle. Hanging bodies on weeping trees, the whole village will come and see. Another nigga is crucified, but that nigga is you and I, it's do or die. Terry Lynn Carrington and Social Science, Trapped in the American Dream, featuring Kasaa Overall. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. in an effort to stop closure of Oakland Unified School District Parker Elementary School and 10 other public schools, parents, teachers, and students have occupied Parker for more than 75 days. It is now a liberation school. On Thursday, August 4th, security guards attacked and beat parents and community supporters. Dozens of nearby community members rallied and stopped the violent attempt to close the school. On Friday, the organizers and supporters called a press conference and spoke about the closure of the school, racism, privatization, and charters destroying public education.
My name is Juan Velasquez. I'm a resident here for 30 years, a parent. I live up the street. I want to be really clear about that question. This isn't trespassing. This is a community building. This is everyone you see standing around here. This is what this was intended for. This building has almost been here for 100 years. There's nobody trespassing. The only people trespassing is OUSD.
That's right.
On this community. And they've been doing this for almost a 20-year period of closing schools and communities that need them the most.
That's right.
These are racist practices.
That I wanted to say, and I want everybody who's watching this, you know, we got all these news stations here. We started this back in on graduation day on May 25th, and we had been fighting the school board for a long time, peacefully fighting. I mean, going to school board meetings, trying to figure out why they are insisting on closing this school, trying to fight the closure. And so we ended up staying, me and Rochelle, when our kids graduated on May 25th. Mm-hmm. And we had the best summer ever. We had over 30 kids that came back here every day, all affected by this closure, all who live in this area. That's what we did it for, was to have something nice. So to show up and to see 5-6 huge security officers drag him in there and then beat him up and hold him hostage in handcuffs for over an hour, that's scary. That's a hostage situation. Nobody would know unless you were here seeing it. We're banging on the door trying to get him out, asking them, please let him out, please let him out. And you can look in there and see him on the floor, on the chair, bloody, in handcuffs with 5-6 big guys around him. That's really terrible. This is a school. This is a school that two mothers and some other parents and community members are trying to keep open. There's no reason that there should be a hostage situation with somebody bleeding on the floor.
To watch them brutally, physically assault parents that are not doing anything violent, that are not doing anything wrong, just trying to provide a space for their children, is the most powerful and most innocent and honest thing that any community member can do for their community. So let's be clear who the enemy is.
That's right.
Who the aggressors are. Who the people that are attacking our children. And that these parents and this community around us is trying to protect. And we've been trying to do this since OUSD has been closing schools in our neighborhoods for almost a 20-year period. The nonsense that the propaganda and the nonsense that OUSD. And let's take one step back. We live in the state of California. The state of California has a $90 billion surplus right now. Okay? We're not in a deficit.
That's right.
We don't have a lack of resources. This is a choice. Yep. This is an attack. And OUSD, by their own data, is not in a fiscal crisis. Mm-hmm. Two more parts of that. We've just been approved in Oakland for community schools, sustainable community schools, which more fund is already being allocated as we speak to Oakland already. Mm-hmm. And there's already a measure on the state level to increase per pupil spending by 13%. So that is nonsense. OUSD is not in a fiscal crisis, and the community, not just here in Oakland, but nationally, needs to stop saying that and believing that
That's
nonsense,
right.
Okay? We should have the best schools in the nation because we have the number one economy in the nation,
That's
period.
Right.
My name is Rebecca Ruiz, R-U-I-Z. I work with an organization called the Anti-Police Terror Project. We've been supporting these mothers and the community from day one of the school liberation, we like to call it, because this is already occupied Ohlone land. You know, I was like thrown against a tile wall, and I just got back from the hospital. This is an attack on Black and brown children, on this community, who simply have the audacity of demanding to learn, right? Demanding to have equitable education.
My name is Michael Shane, and I am a teacher and parent in Oakland Unified School District. Charters in the state have become like a huge problem. It's just not only are they basically given whole campuses, they're also taking public school space, essentially becoming a school on the same campus as a public school. My site that I've taught at for years, King Estates, is chopped up between four different schools now. The scramble for space, where charters are constantly trying to claim extra space, take it from the public school. And they also have, you know, like foundation money, which is private sector money, which allows them to hire people like, you know, to go out and recruit, to, you know, like to do provide extra stuff as far as, you know, the bureaucracies involved that specifically is helpful in, you know, convincing families to leave their public school, go to their charter school. And the other issue, obviously, is that the charters do not provide the same level of education with special ed, language services. All the expensive things that, like, the public school provides for families, charter schools try their damnedest to not provide those services.
My ancestors, my people, they have marched, they have fought, they have died in the streets like dogs just so we can go to school.
That's right.
And get the public education that we need. Martin Luther King and all those people who marched, they didn't die for charter schools, I'm gonna tell you that now.
Exactly.
The Little Rock Nine, those nine people that went into that public school, they didn't go into a charter school. They didn't get beat up and called names and all that stuff for no charter schools. It was for public school. So we can have the right to be educated as well as everybody else. And for them to close schools in our communities, the schools that my ancestors and the people in the civil rights movement have fought for, is a setback. And we will not stand for that. We will not stand for anybody closing any more schools in our communities. We will not stand for gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
We will not stand for modern day colonization,
mm-hmm.
because that's what this is starting to come down to.
That's right.
And then the biggest enemy and the common enemy that we all have is capitalism.
That's right.
Because that plays a hand
that's
in
right.
all of this.
Yes.
The greedy.
Charters make right. money.
The rich versus the poor.
Bissy keeps saying closing schools. They're not closing schools. They're replacing them with charter schools.
Say that. That's right.
Okay? Let's be clear. They haven't been closed. They've been replaced by charter schools
exactly.
that have no public oversight,
yep.
that take public funding
mm-hmm. uh-huh.
and create a profit for those entities, for those school sites.
Come on.
Yep.
The parents and the students and administrators at those sites are not adversaries. They're race baiting and splitting our communities with
uh-huh.
the same nonsense of divide and conquer.
Come on.
So hear that clearly. It's the entities that's the problem. And again, this isn't an Oakland problem. This is a national problem. I've traveled around the country. New Orleans doesn't have a public school system because of this. So we all need to pay attention. The public at home needs to understand what is happening to our public education and what is the attack and the violence against our children and our communities that need this resource. This is the one and only resource we have left in our communities across this nation. And they're closing them and taking them away from us. And that needs to be understood.
Those were voices of parents, teachers, and community supporters of the Oakland Parker Liberation School. For more information about their struggle, visit slapbayarea.org. That's slap, S-L-A-P, bayarea.org. Music by the Yusef Days Experience, live at Joshua Tree, presented by Solection. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Christian extremists in the United States have embraced political violence, according to Frederick Clarkson, a political research associate. Clarkson is a senior research analyst with Political Research Associates, and he spoke with Scott Harris of Between the Lines, a show from WPKN 89.5 FM Pacifica affiliate in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Under Donald Trump's presidency, the nation's Christian right movement prospered, with important rulings in the U.S. Supreme Court made possible by Trump's nomination of three extreme right justices that cemented in place the current conservative supermajority. Recent high court rulings, including the overturning of the 50-year-old Roe v. Wade decision that provided federal protection for women's access to abortion, as well as the Kennedy v. Bremerton School District case that further eroded the separation of church and state, shocked and angered a majority of Americans. The Trump-provoked violent January 6th attack on the Capitol appears to have galvanized many Republican legislators, religious extremists, and armed white supremacist terrorist groups to embrace political violence as a tactic to take power and overturn election results that don't favor Republican candidates. At the state level, this alliance of Republicans and religious nationalist groups have passed legislation that outlaws abortion, even in the case of rape or incest, targets LGBTQ and trans youth, bans books, and the teaching of U.S. history of slavery and racism in public schools. Your reporter spoke with Frederick Clarkson, senior research analyst with Political Research Associates and author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Here he discusses how U.S. Christian extremist groups are embracing political violence as they pursue an agenda that threatens democracy.
After the failed coup in January 6th, some months later, there was an effort to begin to rally the kind of constituencies that came to Washington on January 6th. And they are concerned about a range of things. I mean, some people are concerned about vaccinations and masks. Others are concerned about election integrity, as they call it. But also people are concerned about their particular vision of how to create a more theocratic society. Many of them are driven by conspiracist visions of demonic spirits controlling society and how to drive them off. Now, the Christian right has done very well politically over the last few decades, but one of the things they learned is that they can't do it by themselves, or at least they can't do enough by themselves. So they're involved with some of the kinds of people we see on January 6th now, and at the Reawaken Tour, led by Michael Flynn and populated by headliners like Eric Trump and Mike Lindell, the pillow guy, and a lot of election denier kinds of people, but also people who are important in the conservative Christian world, who most people have never heard of, like a man named Lance Wall now, who's a prophet in this world. He's also a smart political strategist. He's the guy who came up with a biblical justification for Donald Trump, who one would think would never have passed muster with conservative Christians, being the kind of man that he was. So we are seeing this fusion of conspiracist thinking, the QAnon people, the anti-vax people, the theocrats, rallying themselves, thousands of people at a time, 15 big rallies in big cities around the country. Most recent one was in Virginia Beach. So it's kind of a rolling revolt and organizing and a cohering of this far-right ideology that's ultimately anti-democratic.
You know, I did want to ask you about Pastor Greg Locke. I think he got a lot of publicity recently when a clip of his just unhinged rant, I don't think you could call it a sermon, where he was attacking Democrats as godless communists who don't deserve to live, in essence, and warning about the next insurrection, really threatening violence from the pulpit. I don't know if he's typical of a lot of these folks in the extreme right in the religious movement in this country, but tell us a little bit about Greg Locke and his vision as compared to others in this same movement.
Well, I think his vision is similar. I think he's much more of a fire-breathing provocateur than even some of the others, offering the most militant, vile, and divisive, provocative language that he can think of. That's what Greg Locke is like. His church in Tennessee is actually a tent. You know, he's brought the old-time tent revival style to militant contemporary theocratic politics. And he'd be somebody who wouldn't take that seriously, except that he's been on the Reawaken tour with Michael Flynn. So he's given that stage and allowed to put out those kinds of messages. He's also become notorious for organizing a big bonfire of Harry Potter books, which he sees as demonic witchcraft. How far he's willing to go in terms of encouraging directly violence, I don't know. But he's not alone in creating a vision in which violence is justified to carry out their aims. And we've always seen these people. I've seen them over many years, over many decades. But there are more of them than there used to be, and they're better organized, and they're being given platforms and alliances by the likes of Michael Flynn.
Fred, we don't have a lot of time left, but briefly tell us about Republican candidate Doug Mastriano, who won his party's nomination for Pennsylvania governor in this November's general election. He'll be going up against Democratic candidate Josh Shapiro, the state's incumbent attorney general. What would you want our listeners to first and foremost know about Doug Mastriano?
Doug Mastriano is the Christian right's dream candidate. Right? He's in and of their world. I looked at the groups that are supporting him, some of the individuals, and they're the very kinds of people we've been talking about through all of this, people who believe in taking the seven mountains of society. They like him, not just because he agrees with them in these things, but also because he's a retired Army strategist and intelligence officer. And he brings the skills and the sensibility of leading armies, right, to the work of the state legislature and to the work of politics. Republican and Democratic campaign operatives can't figure out why he's competitive with a well-established candidate like Josh Shapiro, the Democrat in the governor's race. But he is running a campaign in his own way, mobilizing the kinds of hidden forces that I'm talking about here, because most people don't participate in election processes, even in a good year. But he knows that he can turn out his people and be competitive.
His vow to overturn an election result he doesn't like as governor. It's frightening stuff.
Well, it is indeed. And also keep in mind that the world of Army intelligence is a small world. Mm-hmm. That's where Michael Flynn came out of. And there is a number of senior, retired Army intelligence officers who are working a scene nationally. And it's not just Doug Mastriano and not just Michael Flynn.
That was Frederick Clarkson, senior research analyst with Political Research Associates, and author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy.
That was Scott Harris of Pacifica affiliate WPN's show, Between the Lines.
Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive, or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean, or Czech, a lesbian, or a gay? Would you harbor me?
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock, Would You Harbor Me? The use of technology to spy on workers is now expanding to not only tracking workers' every move, but also registering the heartbeat, sweat, and emotions of workers on the job. Professor Peter Mantello, who teaches in Japan, has been studying empathetic surveillance and what this means for working people. He has written a paper called The Machine That Ate Bad People. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer interviewed Mantello about what these technologies are and their dangers in the workplace.
I think technology, ever since the late 19th century, has been used as a tool to enhance productivity. But also, the flip side to that is technology has been a way to augment supervision of the worker. In the late 19th century, you have the punch clock, which became, in many ways, a kind of a replacement for the eyes of the foreman. But also it sped up the accounting process. And increasingly what we see with technology is more, more invasive ways in which to surveil the worker, to ensure that the worker is working, but working at the optimum of his productive potential. And since the rise of the computer, the rhetoric behind that rise in the industry that wanted to use the computer as a way to facilitate higher degrees of productivity, it was seen as a tool of liberation, meaning that like many forms of technology, the rhetoric was is it would unchain the worker, it would allow the worker greater periods of freedom. But as we've seen with the internet and the fact that most workers today are responsible for receiving their emails or responding to their emails at any time of the day, what we're seeing is that the computer and technology itself is becoming more and more a form of surveillance. And instead of being a liberator, it's more something that is enslaving people.
So it's a 24-hour workday.
It's like a 24-hour workday. And the idea, what we see today, especially with gig economy and the use of platform work, we see this sort of the rhetoric behind companies like Uber and Lyft talking about the ability of people to be their own boss. And as a matter of fact, as you know, Uber and Lyft, they don't call their drivers employees, because that would open them for greater responsibility to these people. They're called associates. And they've used that successfully in many countries. Whereas in other countries today, what we're seeing in Europe is pushback, where in fact, people who work for these platform companies are actually employees. And as such, they're entitled to benefits that normal employees have in the normal workplace.
And even in Sweden, the introduction of new technology, like scanners, for example, the scanning machine, they do testing to find out how they affect workers. In the United States, scanners were introduced and you had carpal tunnel syndrome as a result of clerks. So a massive number of injuries to the hands and that kind of thing. So there was no protection from this technology, even though there was studies that showed that it would be harmful to workers.
Technologies that are used in the workplace, let's call them automated management systems, rely on biometrics. Biometrics are the measurement of body. And since the 1980s, biometrics have been used, for example, eye scanners, more frequently with GPS for commercial vehicle companies. To track the location of workers. You know, the area of research that we're working on now is emotional AI, which is technologies that claim to be able to detect, read, and to measure the emotions of people. So what you see is a far more invasive form of surveillance that is going into very private and intimate places of a person's subjective state. And these technologies use very interesting biometrics where they look at like respiration rate, heart rate, skin conductance levels, which is the amount of sweat on your skin, eye tracking micro expressions on your face. And then, of course, using big data and machine learning to come up with readings of a person's emotions. But the problem here is that the science itself is quite flaky. There are two basic problems with the science. One is that the actual science community has no agreement and has contested exactly what emotions are and where they come from. You know, one side of the debate is that emotions are hardwired into your physical body and that people just react. And the other camp says that emotions are contingent on socially and culturally contingent. And of course, much of the facial recognition systems that are being used today rely on a now discredited template that was created by a sociologist called Paul Ekman in the late 20th century, where Paul Ekman decided that universally humans had six emotions. And since facial recognition pushback within the last, I would say, 3 years, there are many scholars that are saying that this is pretty flaky because all cultures express their emotions differently. For example, in Thailand, one of the most common emotions that a person will display when they are embarrassed is they'll smile or they'll laugh. Whereas in Russia, you know, Russians are known for not smiling at all sometimes, you know. So
so your cultural differences affect your expressions and your emotions.
Yeah, exactly. Culture is a great determiner of person's emotional, the way people express emotions.
Now, algorithms have been used to track people and to find out what people are going to do, and it's led to discrimination. Algorithms, the difference between blacks and whites of targeted. Why don't you talk about the use of algorithms and biomed technology?
Yeah, that's really interesting too, because my focus within the last couple of years has been on AI in the workplace. And the problem with the technologies that are being created and the algorithms that are being used is that many of these algorithms that are created, many of these technologies are being built here in Silicon Valley. And so we have programmers who are deciding on what happiness is, what sadness is. And the problem here is that these technologies are being marketed globally across the world, and they're not tweaked for any forms of diversity, for gender, for ethnicity, for race. So we have this sort of generic type of technology, but of course it's being used all over the place. And right now I say that there's this bandwagon going on where because of this perfect storm of disaster capitalism, which is COVID, and surveillance capitalism coming together, we have these companies, and where I work in Japan, companies that have been historically, traditionally reluctant to embrace new technologies, all of a sudden embracing these technologies without questioning the validity of the science behind them.
That was Pacifica Steve Seltzer and Professor Peter Mantello about the use of technology in studying the emotions and biometrics of workers on the job to increase productivity. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasilia, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this in all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.